This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. Hello and welcome to LGIM's CIO call. I'm Frances Watson, content manager, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Mike Barry, Director of Fund Management in Real Assets, and Xuan Chan, Head of ESG and also in the Real Assets team. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to LGIM Talks.
Good morning.
Now, Sonia, not a terribly pretty picture out there, is it, for investors? Not least because investor sentiment has been so guided by this quite aggressive central bank narrative, which has shifted so significantly since the turn of the year. We are almost 6 months on into the year. The key question, I guess, is where do investors go from here?
Thanks for the introduction. And I think you're very right to call out that we've had an almighty adjustment process in markets in a very, very short period of time. I have a number of times just taken a step back to make sure we all know where we've come from since the beginning of the year, where literally the narrative was still for rather modest interest rate hikes throughout the year. And clearly, obviously, we did not have any geopolitical risks of the magnitude we're currently witnessing in our forecast. So you now fast forward to the mid-May period we're currently seeing, and you have seen a level of monetary tightening that had to be priced in markets, obviously very much driven on the back of inflation prints that, again, we have to go back to the 70s to see anything equivalent. And as such, obviously, an adjustment process that has started from global bond yield levels that have been near the zero lower bound, and as such, obviously, has created a lot of volatility. I think what I would like to call out is that investors are now, you know, post this initial adjustment process, clearly are grappling with two questions. Point one, will this monetary tightening lead to a recession? Because the growth outlook clearly has been reduced on the back of the geopolitical tensions and the aggressive monetary tightening. And secondly, you know, where do we go with regards to the positioning within markets? I think most remarkable for most has been the fact that all asset classes have been down. There was no way to hide. And this is quite different, i.e. the equity bond relationship clearly has caught a lot of attention because it has turned and we've had negative returns in global bonds and in global equities. And again, I think this is related to obviously the massive adjustment process on the back of monetary tightening. But again, if you try to figure out where from here, it's clear that the growth outlook and the inflation outlook will dominate and will continue to dominate investors' mind. We've said a number of times that how to position within this. Point one is to understand how you position yourself in an inflationary environment. And again, we've stressed a number of times this has not been a dominant driver of market returns for a very long period of time, particularly not in the developed world. You have to go back to the 70s and 80s to have an inflationary backdrop that would look similar to what we experience right now. And I can't stress it enough because it's such a dramatic shift in the major goalposts that will dominate markets, that understanding the drivers of inflation and obviously on top, understanding the other structural changes. We should not forget, we're still working through the post-pandemic normalization period, which in and of itself has been a major driver of inflationary tendencies, but has created obviously a lot of other question marks that investors are grappling with. And there will be a number of big themes that investors should look at that will come out of this current episode and that will drive potentially the opportunity set of what we're looking for. ESG will remain one, and I know we're talking about this a bit later. As I said, post-pandemic normalization, and given that we are talking about real assets today, obviously hybrid working and the future of the office clearly will be other aspects. But thematic and understanding those structural themes will help investors to navigate what will be incredibly volatile markets, because until the market will find a footing with regards to the recession outlook and the inflationary pathway, it will remain very difficult to see how this turns out from here.
Yes, I mean, you've mentioned quite a few times in your narrative, Sonia, the 1970s. I'm just about old enough to know and remember those times, and quite tough they were too. Talking of tough, Mike, in the real estate equity sphere, you've got a background of slowing growth and rising inflation. So how are you grappling with the dynamics of your asset class at the moment?
It's interesting. Real estate is really interesting because, in a sense, the sentiment has stayed pretty positive. I won't say that it's wholly positive, but in a sense, it has stayed very positive through Q1. We've still got capital coming into our space. The themes that we're seeing at the end of last year continued through Q1 and have continued in the last few months, with allocations going to industrial, which has been a very much growth space, and residential, where we've seen this growth of the institutional built-to-rent markets. So, and a lot of money flowing that way. And again, net zero carbon and all the impacts investing coming to the fore. And that's a theme that we know is going to perpetuate, and we know is something which is critical in terms of decision-making around real estate. What maybe has changed very recently is a sort of slight shift in sentiment and a sort of growing caution coming through what we're seeing in the other markets. Clearly, we're impacted by rising debt costs, which in part was a part of our market, even though in the UK we're quite heavily equity-based in terms of investment. And maybe a focus on those sectors where they're reliant on strong rent growth to underpin pricing. And then alongside that, I guess the other note of caution has been around construction costs and material shortages, which we've seen. So that, again, has delayed projects and given us a moment really to reflect on site pricing and how to proceed with those schemes, which will proceed, I believe. But ultimately, there's been a slight delay as we reconsider some of the dynamics. To underpin the point to say that actually real estate has actually had a good year to date, you know, the returns for Q1 were roughly 5%. We've seen capital growth in April of 1.3%. We expect to see capital growth still in May as valuations come through at maybe 0.5 to 1%. So it's a sort of, I think our market is in a state where it's considering some of the impacts we're seeing elsewhere. But in terms of statistics, actually the numbers are still strong and have shown that actually we've been able to sort of slightly separate ourselves so far.
Would that be fair to say, Mike, that you're feeling a little bit more optimistic on life because you are a late cycle asset class? Would that have something to do with it, do you think?
I think that's fair. I also believe that we're a relatively high yield asset class, which again has given us a slight cushion versus some of the rising sort of bond rates. And in parts of our market, we have very, very low vacancy rates. So we have, if you like, inherent demand coming through, which drives rents and drives pricing. So I think, I guess we are watching carefully the capital allocations because we've seen, it's been spoken about for a long time that it's an underallocated sector. But I guess given the backdrop we're seeing, given the pressures we're seeing, you could imagine a situation where some of that capital at least goes on hold for a while until the markets calm down.
Okay. Now you've both alluded, Sonia and Mike, to the pressing need for net zero. And of course, let's bring Shwen in here because as head of ESG in real assets, that's kind of what you live and breathe, isn't it? So tell us, Shwen, if you will, how you're addressing in this environment the environmental considerations across the real asset portfolios.
Well, I think as we grapple with these economic and structural shifts and its implications over the coming years and potentially decades, climate change remains a significant systemic risk to our financial system. So it's very clear that the question is no longer if, but to what extent, where, and how we should respond, adapt, and build more resiliency in our portfolios. So from a real assets perspective, as long-term investors in the built environment and infrastructure, we are effectively investing in the real economy. And at Elgin, we address our ESG objectives in real assets through six core pillars that interconnect. And they are net zero, circular economy, nature-based solutions and biodiversity, climate resilience, health and well-being, and social impact. So I'll give three examples here that touch on net zero and climate resilience. The first is about understanding the changing regulatory landscape in the building sector and how that fits with our net zero commitments. And it's about setting the right targets. The second is about the how. What are we actually doing to meet those targets? And the third point is about climate resilience. So the first, which is this regulatory context that we're all facing. An example is the Minimum Energy Efficiency Standards, the MEES, that will be tightening significantly over the next 5 to 7 years as the government mandates changes, and that takes the market closer to net zero standards. So as part of our commitment to achieving net zero across our entire real estate equity portfolio, we have established our net zero roadmap over about 2 years ago and have also set science-based targets to 2030. And since then, we have been actively implementing measures to transition our portfolio, which brings me to the second point, which is the how. So for net zero, we take a whole life cycle approach following the UK Green Buildings Council framework. And that means we are looking at taking into account embodied carbon in the construction, all the way to the operational carbon when these buildings are in use. So for example, the measures would include removing gas boilers, replacing them with air source heat pumps, reducing energy demand through plant and fabric upgrades, and reusing what would otherwise have been waste material that links to circular economy, and as well as installing solar PV to generate renewable electricity on site to cut the building's base bill operational energy consumption. And finally, the third point is on climate resilience. And this is very much about adapting our portfolios to take into account possible future scenarios as a result of climate physical risk. Now, our analysis shows us that flood risk poses the biggest current and future threat to our UK-based real estate portfolio. And so we have undertaken forward-looking risk assessments as part of our work to support the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure recommendations across all assets in our portfolio. And that's looking, taking a forward-looking view over the next 10, 20, and all the way up to year 2100. And this has provided us with decision-useful data and information that will potentially impact our investment decisions or help us develop specific adaptation measures at the building level.
I guess what you're telling me, Shwen, is that you're not only talking the talk, but you're seriously walking the walk. Just quickly, and against the background of this awful cost of living crisis for an awful lot of people, what are you doing in the built environment to highlight the social impact?
Well, I think what we need to remember is we're long-term investors in the real asset space. So whilst we focus on driving investment performance for investors, it goes hand in hand with our responsibility to improve and contribute to positive societal outcomes and what we refer to as place-based impact across the assets that we own and we manage. And what that means is that we can't achieve our decarbonization targets without ensuring that our investment decisions lead to better health and well-being of the communities where our assets are based and supporting a more equitable and just transition.
So let's just go back to the economics of investing, if you like, Mike. You touched briefly on rental growth. That seems to be okay to me. But the key question again, I guess, is it keeping up with inflation?
I think it's pretty hard to keep up with inflation rates we've just seen. So we have seen some very strong rent growth come through in the last couple of years. The start of this year, I think rents are rising probably on an annual basis around 3%. And for very prime real estate, then maybe it is hitting around 7%. So you can see there is a rental growth story here. But clearly, given inflation rates announced today, 9% in the UK, then that is, whilst we're all hopeful that that's temporary, it is sort of an extreme rate of change. There's definitely a view that real estate is a hedge of sorts to inflation. I think it does depend on the drivers of inflation, and it does depend on the sector and the time horizon as to the extent to which that is true. But it probably is at least a partial hedge, I'd say, and that's the view certainly we would adopt. Sectorally, you can see that industrial rents are still very supply constrained market, as I said before, and rental rates are growing at a rapid rate. Although again, they will not be immune from cost pressures coming through. Certainly, those businesses, and there is something called a rates revaluation on the horizon for industrial, which again will have an impact. And residential, we definitely see BTR as a resilient markets. There is a direct link there to wage inflation in terms of how that feeds through into your ability to pay the rents. There's also a link to increased mortgage costs, which again mean that there's a greater case for rental. So we actually see that as a resilient market. I would sort of also add from a cost of living point of view, I mean, we've done some analysis which says that living in our clearly very modern, purpose-built residential blocks, you know, an average renter is saving around £100 a month on their energy bills by being in there rather than being in a standard private rented building. So there are other benefits, I guess, which we see as being important in this space.
And that brings me on to my next point, Mike, because yes, that's great that they're buffered, if you like, from rising energy costs. But obviously, we have an energy security crisis. I mean, we can't not acknowledge it. And Shwen, I know you want to say a bit about that. But first of all, Sonia, if you could paint the background picture for us. You know, geopolitical tensions, which have caused this energy crisis, haven't they? How are they affecting the way we look at responsible investing more broadly?
Yeah, it's a very important topic, because it's clear that we have seen a lot of attention to actual three areas of responsible investing. And regular listeners to our podcast know that we have focused a lot on the acceleration in responsible investing, in the way we have to take it forward and how investors would look at it. But it's very clear that the invasion of Ukraine now is putting a spotlight on three areas in particular. One is the path to net zero and how you can balance it with the energy security question that clearly is linked to the invasion. This is particularly a question for Europe, where energy dependency and the dependency on Russian oil and gas for a country like Germany amounts to more than 30% in the case of gas, and obviously even more when you add oil to it. So it has exposed an awful dependency, which now is questioning the validity of plans put forward by, for example, the German government, whether their net zero ambition is in fact feasible, and whether the now desire to wean itself off of Russian gas will interfere with that plan. And clearly what it does, and this is the kind of cost of living crisis at its best, it's driving energy prices to levels that will hit growth, that will hit consumers in their pockets. And as such, from a political standpoint, it's very clear that there's a lot of tension on how you get it right. We still believe that the path to net zero is achievable, but we have to accept as well that it might come at a cost in the near term, i.e. some governments might need to have to revert back to coal or other energy sources in order to accommodate the political will to reduce dependency from Russian gas. But at the same time, hopefully, it will trigger an even stronger and greater emphasis on private capital and capital overall being put to work in order to accelerate the renewable energy pathway. That's clearly probably the most prominent right now, because it features across the inflation spectrum. It features obviously in our responsible investing framework, and it's a very uncomfortable position for politicians, and I believe it will get a lot of airtime in the near term. The other two areas are again directly related to the invasion of Ukraine, and it's one, the treatment of defense companies and whether they should be in fact eligible within responsible investing portfolios, and the last one is the assessment of sovereigns. Again, you know, there has been a very immediate focus on removing Russia from most indices that are available. That had consequences on how we have to not only reduce our holdings, but how we ring fence these holdings, because clearly equity markets in particular are still shut for foreign investors. So even if written down to zero, most of these funds would still own the securities and obviously eventually will need to try and sell it. And in that context, there obviously was a lot of headlines being published by asset managers that there would be no new investments in Russian securities. We are now receiving more questions from our clients. How do you then look at other controversial sovereigns? And it's clear that the industry need to advance the initial thinking that has always been there in the background, but has never been put forward into a formalized framework. How do you score a country based on its human rights track records, based on other common available data points around, you know, the way the rule of law is implemented, how many treaties they sign? So there's common factors that we should apply But obviously, it's clear that it's fraught with difficulty how you put it into the investment world and what consequences you take away from a scoring framework. But it's very clear that these three areas will be yet again another massive evolution in our responsible investing framework that is directly related to the geopolitical tensions that have arisen and will hopefully, again, clarify some of those positions. But it's clear that we need to put a lot of thinking in there to make sure that it is a fair framework that can be applied across the board and that it's based on facts and a good understanding of the relevant data points in order to come to the right outcome for our clients.
That's a huge amount of extra work for you all, both in terms of sensitivities, transparency, and discussion and dialogue. And I get that. With you, Xuan, in terms of, you know, part of the thing that Sonia has outlined about the energy security crisis on the one hand, at the same time, and the need to tackle climate change on the other, what actually are occupiers? How are they feeling about all of this? What are they telling you?
I think the first thing to recognize is that our net zero commitments and targets cover what we call scope 1, 2, and 3. And it's the scope 3, which are the emissions generated by the energy consumption controlled by our occupiers, which is the biggest challenge to get to net zero. So we have a very large and diversified portfolio across the UK. It's a diversified portfolio spanning different sectors from commercial, multi-let offices, industrial, retail, leisure, and built-to-rent sectors. Half of which are managed assets, which are buildings where we control the energy consumption, and the other half, thereabouts, are based on long-term leases. And these are where tenants control their own energy consumption. So you're absolutely right that engagement with our occupiers, that is that scope three piece, is vital to achieving our net zero objectives. So when it comes to tackling challenges such as climate change, we need to recognize that our occupiers are at different stages of that journey. Some who are large multinationals, for example, they themselves have net zero commitments. So the conversations become more aligned in terms of having shared ambitions and hence shared challenges to overcome through collaboration. But we also have a large number of SME occupiers, small medium enterprises, who frankly have different priorities, given especially the current inflationary pressures. And they're also hit by high energy costs. So actually, we feel that these occupiers will actually be interested to engage with us because we can help them get on their journey to net zero, which will ultimately reduce their energy costs in the long term as they switch out of gas into more renewable energy sources. So it's very much about tailoring our approach depending on the needs and priorities of our different occupiers. And this comes through education, utilizing technology-based tools where appropriate that enhance the way we engage and share information with our occupiers. And that's a key priority for us.
You know, especially the small and medium-sized enterprises have a lot to think about, not least the cost of implementing everything, don't they? I just want to turn back to you, Sonia, now, and to more traditional markets, let's say, of equities and bonds. I mean, the talk in the market seems to be of growing recession risks. Some analysts would say that given recent falls, that's priced in already. But how should investors be accounting for the theme across portfolios? And just sum it up for us. Give us your final thoughts.
Yes, very much too. It is clear that recession risk has gone up. There's no doubt about it. Do we have all the ingredients yet that would give us the certainty when it's going to happen? No, we don't. And I think we have to be humble enough that the geopolitical situation is adding a level of complexity and uncertainty into the mix that makes the forecasting ever more complicated. Just take the case of Europe. It's very clear the longer the invasion goes on, the higher the risk that a recession will occur because the pressure on the global energy system, the cost of living crisis, will have a direct impact on consumers. And the impact is felt far more directly here in Europe. And so you have a direct link between the two. But hence, you know, my view on the geopolitical situation is as educated as most commentators will have out there. So I'm not claiming we have any material insight in how long this will go on for, but we do know that the longer it will, the higher the risks. And I think that's the way we have been approaching this. The mantra on the sixth floor, i.e. our investment floor, always has been that we shouldn't try to predict, because we don't have any additional insights that others don't. You can only prepare, and you can try and understand what the implications are if the situation were to get worse. There has been a lot of talk around this idea of soft landing, which is interesting. Jay Powell, in particular, in his latest communication, was referring to the fact that they've assumed that they would be able to produce a soft landing on the basis of their rate hikes. I think we have to question this, because the level of monetary tightening that the system has to absorb makes it feel unlikely that a recession is unavoidable. But now our current forecast for the US is only by the second half of 23. And as such, obviously, you will still have a time lag before this is really come to fruition. For Europe, we probably see it happening earlier, simply because of the direct impact of the geopolitical situation. Now, what this means for markets in the context of that time period, equities normally enjoy a relatively positive final leg of the cycle, because they, if you think about it, have a better inflation hedge embedded than bonds. So you normally see the bond market react first to the hiking cycle. And equities actually enjoying still the final leg of growth, because let's face it, the Fed is hiking rates because the labor market is tight, because we have the economy operating above capacity. That's normally good for earnings. Now, it is a bit more complex this time around because of the geopolitical situation. And obviously, because inflation is so high that we still need to see which companies can actually pass on the high inflation to their end consumer, and where the companies that might feel the squeeze already. So it is more about really understanding which areas might still look attractive for the last part of the cycle. But I think we had to realize that the speed with which markets had to adjust to the monetary tightening, the magnitude of monetary tightening, the expectation that the Fed might even have to hike more than what is the assumed neutral rate, simply because they fear they can't rein in inflation expectations, just is a more difficult mix. And as such, we would probably not make too many changes at this point until we have greater clarity on how the cycle is going to end. Thematically, we are trying to understand what will drive the opportunity set. And obviously, we've covered quite a lot already, in particular around ESG, because it will remain such a dominant driver. So understanding the balancing act between energy security and the path to net zero will again give us insight in terms of opportunities. The understanding of the longer term geopolitical consequences will give us insight in how companies will have to react to this. We've talked about the disruption of global supply chains in the context of the pandemic, and it has given us a first insight what happens actually if you will see a trend towards deglobalization, towards supply chains being disentangled and moving to more local levels. And it will have an impact on how companies will have to absorb the cost and what it does to margins. And hence, again, will give you an insight on the opportunity set, how investors should look at it. You have said it already, Francis, the market has priced in a lot already. So we are probably looking at tactical opportunities as well, because we are very clear, you have to be more active in your choices. You have to realize that the bond equity correlation has changed, and as such, your usual hedging and diversification benefits you might not find as readily in bond markets as you used to. But clearly, if you look at bond yields, for example, the short end in the emerging market debt space is yielding you more than 7%, and that is a lot more than you were that you were willing and ready to find just a couple of quarters ago. Mm-hmm. So there is obviously an adjustment process, and we have seen a lot of pain being absorbed already. But I would still not go for a wholehearted change until we know and have a clearer picture on the recession risk. But it's clearly always an opportune moment to identify opportunities where either the repricing has been too much or we have a structural driver behind the theme that looks to outgrow the global economy in the near future.
It's almost a case-by-case basis, I suppose, for investors at the moment, isn't it? And who would be in Jay Powell's shoes at the moment with that sort of walking that tightrope? Well, let's go from stress in the markets to a little bit more of a relaxed question for you all. And of course, Max would never forgive me if I didn't ask you what you had all been watching, reading or listening to recently. So I'm going to kick off and I'm going to cheat slightly and say I've been out in the garden a lot, weeding mainly. But the book I've picked up is by Monty Don called Gardening at Longmeadow. It's a fairly old book. You probably know it, but it's full of pictures and tips for your garden. And it's absolutely lovely. And when you're stressed, it's well worth a read. So, Sonia, let's go to you.
Thank you.
How about you?
I have had the amazing opportunity to attend a conference just last week, and there was a speaker. His name is Fareed Zakaria, and he works for the CNN. And he was a fascinating speaker. I've rarely seen someone who so eloquently can summarize the geopolitical situation in the context of history and then looking forward. And he has written a book that's called 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World, which I'm about to start reading. But based on the speech he's given there, I'm very much looking forward to that.
Great. Xuan, should we go to you?
So finally, you shared your story about your garden interest. I've actually been listening to a podcast this week that actually came out during the lockdown last year called Reintroduction and Rewilding. So it's essentially a short series of episodes that led up to an online summit that talks about the importance of rewilding and the reintroduction of native animals that once flourished in the UK, such as beavers. So did you know, Francis, that beavers were native to Britain a few hundred years ago?
I didn't know that. Yeah. No, we've got a nature theme going on, haven't we? Mike, last but not least, of course, how about you?
I was in danger of bringing down the tone and talking about Eurovision, but I think I'll leave that, although I did enjoy it for a change.
It was great, wasn't it?
It was great. I think we're currently I've watched a few podcasts recently by a gentleman called Rory Sutherland, who specializes in behavioral sciences, and we're actually looking quite hard at using them on a number of our schemes. So, and he is entertaining and he is interesting. And I think for real estate, actually, as we get closer and closer to our occupiers, strangely enough, how people behave and how they think and how they make their decisions is actually incredibly, incredibly interesting. So actually he's done quite a number of podcasts. So there's a few to get through if you're interested, but he's a very interesting speaker.
That sounds great. And of course, if none of that takes your fancy as listeners, you can always read our LGM CIO Spring Outlook, of course, which you can read more of Sonia's views there, as well as those of other experts. And that's available on our usual pages of our website at lgm.com. But for now, thanks so much to all of our guests. I know how busy you are just from listening to you. Busy time. So thank you for joining me on the CIO call today. And thank you to all for listening. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording, and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, elgim.com. Copyright 2021, Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, a licensed corporation, BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.